Okay, thank you, Brian. Oh, it's a bit wobbly. Okay, so I'm going to talk about computing education. I'm going to talk about computing education research. And when I was asked to give a title for this talk, it was a long time ago. So I said, well, I'll put up a title that I can talk about anything. So here's the title, but I've tried subsequently to keep to the brief. So it's Computing Education Research, Who's It For, and Why. So I want to address this concept of computing education research as part of a continuum. I may stray and I may claim a wider scope for it, but I want to look at it as having a place on a path. And I want to particularly emphasise this path is in a very interesting sense linear, and that the levels that I'm talking about interact with each other where they touch. And so the continuum I want to look at is teaching, which we all do and we're all here for, at one end. Research on the other end, which some of us do a bit of, what have you. Computing education research, which I think is closer to our hearts. And then an interesting fourth level, which is teacher research, or teacher researcher. So how are these levels related? I think they're related on a continuum, and the continuum is a continuum of abstraction. It's a continuum of representation, and it's a continuum of questions. And I want to look at all of those to see how these levels split out along this path. So let's look at abstraction and representation. They kind of go hand in hand. So what characterises, and in fact I want to say caricatures, you know, please don't go and quote me in saying, Sally Fincher says this is what research is. Okay. This is a caricature, this is characterisation. What is research and research knowledge? It's abstract knowledge. Okay? It's generalisable, it's replicable, it's predictive. This is, we know from coming from math and science traditions, this is what we look for when we look for a piece of research, we take it down. Can we see this? Well, no, you can't. You can't really see the act of research or the research happening. But we can see traces of where it's been. We can look at the representations that it leaves behind and take some characteristics from those. And so I'm going to take a representation not from computer science at the moment. I'm going to take a representation from chemistry. This is from Angewandte Chemie, which means applied chemistry in German. And you can tell it's a chemistry paper. You can tell it's not a computer science paper. It's got little diagrams in. It's got some characteristics that we don't see. And a typical paper in this journal is about 3 pages long. And 1 page contains experimental detail. Half a page is endnotes, not something we have very much in computing. But in chemistry and other disciplines, I mean, history, famously, most of the paper is endnotes. The body of the article is 1.5 printed pages, and roughly a third of that is graphics. So you've got a very clear sense of how this knowledge is represented. A feature of this particular journal is an experimental section at the end. This is mandatory. The journal editors have said you have to have this for every paper that's published in this journal. And let's have a look at that. So this is the experimental section, and it says, all potassium bromide, they were prepared according to the book rule, and it goes on in immense detail of what you have to do. And this is a general statement that in effect states that anyone, anytime, anywhere who treats the same ingredients the same way as I did will make the same chemical compound. That's very characteristic of what we know to be research knowledge. That's how we characterise this abstraction, that you can take it and you can use it anywhere. Well, if we look at the other end of the spectrum, we know that teaching isn't like that. It's not how it happens. Replication of my teaching practice is not guaranteed by the scientific method. I cannot take the same ingredients, the same as you do, and get the same result. I can't even take the same ingredients that I took in my class the last time, reuse them, and get the same result. It just doesn't happen like that. So what then characterises, or caricatures in my cartoon way here, teaching? How is this different from the knowledge and the representations of knowledge that we've seen in research? Well, it's situated. It's absolutely about classrooms and context. I teach at the University of Kent, and I have certain constraints. We use general purpose classrooms. I'm in there 1 minute, my colleagues from physics are in the next. I was visiting at the University of Hartford this week. They have dedicated classrooms with instrumented seats. They can throw up students' work onto the screen behind them. That's a context that I can't replicate. My teaching, I would have to adapt my teaching to the new context, to the new classroom. It's not abstract, it's very situated. It's also contingent knowledge. Not all I know about teaching is enacted in every class I'm in. It depends on the students in front of me. It depends on the questions they ask. It depends on the knowledge they bring with them. It's different every time I do it. And it's embodied. I know six, maybe more, seven, eight ways to teach recursion, but you wouldn't know that just by coming and talking to me, and that knowledge, I may never write it down, I may never share it. It lives and it dies with me. Can we see this? Can we see this teaching? No, we can't. But we can again see it in traces. We can see in representations of the knowledge that it leaves. So they're not quite the same as a research representation. This is me. This is my teaching. This is a course that I did. And I said, how is my teaching represented? So there are institutional representations. So programme specifications, how a student moves through a programme. And we have to approve every module that we offer. So it has to go through institutional approval. We also have departmental representations. So each module, we have an internal representation. We have curriculum pathways we publish to the students. We have annual monitoring reports. So every year we see how it's gone and we do that. And those are the sort of the official documentations, if you like, where my teachings are officially represented. But of course, I do a lot of work designing it. Syllabuses, reading lists, lectures, all these are part of my teaching. But then this is just sort of, if you like, the peripheral stuff, the backstage stuff. When you're on the stage, when you're in front of the students, there's a whole, this co-created contingent nature. There's the notes, there's the student slides, there's my podcasts of my lectures, there's questions, there's discussions. We have what we call anonymous question pages, so students can pose questions without feeling foolish, and we answer them, and all the students get the benefit of the result. That's a representation of my teaching as much as any of the others. Then, of course, all of these are archived, and so it's not just this single instance, but you can go back 2, 3, 4, 5 years. Well, I did that just out of interest, my own interest, and I was quite taken with how diverse this was. So I asked some other people how their teaching was represented. So this is a different notion, and this this person has used some interesting axes. So their axes are from staff to student. The x-axis is on the bottom there. And then from personal to institutional. Don't know if that works. On the y-axis up there. And so you can see they've located how their teaching is represented here, from their own personal notes up to student feedback, with some co-constructed stuff in the middle, the assessments, the official descriptions. Here's another one. This person has used a different distinction. So they have external, external representations they call regulations, timetabling, stuff that I hadn't really considered when I thought about my own work. They have conceptual as the middle layer, and then they have physical as their third notion of where their teaching is represented. This last one they asked, they didn't use pen and paper, they used sticky notes, so they have lots of pieces of work here. They have QA stuff, glossy brochure, exams. And then as they went on and built this up, they put some notes on, and they've said, how many times is a given fact present in all this? Because they suddenly realised that there's a lot of redundancy here. And then, are these all the same? So when we start to look at these representations, some questions arise. And certainly it's fairly obvious that these representations are not abstract in the way that that paper was, in the way that those little molecular diagrams, in the way that the experimental section was in the back of that. They're not singular. There's not a single thing. There's not a paper. There's not a presentation. There's lots of bits and pieces. There's no common shared form of packaging them up. There's no way I can take mine and give it to you and say, here, you use this. There's no experimental section. And what you get is a rather messy, quotidian collection of naturally occurring stuff that comes out of this situated practice. And I think it comes out of as much the nature of the practice as the nature of the representation. So those are, if you like, what I call the two ends of the scales there. And researchers read and consume the research papers. Teachers produce this cyclical mess of stuff, some of which they'll take with them if they change institutions, some of which is very institutionally specific and will stay with them. Computing education research, which I haven't talked too much about yet, also has, we will read each other's papers, we will see what each other's doing, we will comment on it. But also, there is some notion that teachers will consume the products of research, and particularly of computing education research. In a sense, why else are we doing it if we're not trying to change practice? But that jumping across these levels, I think, is a little bit problematic. Because researchers produce evidence in the form that they consume it. And this is a quote that I'm very fond of, which says, "The implicit assumption is that if educators are exposed to carefully presented and understandable research findings, they will recognise the wisdom of the results and immediately employ them in their daily practice." Well, maybe. Brian mentioned that I've been running something called the Share Project, and one of the things that we've been looking at in this is how educators change their practice, and how they change it, when they change it, and with what evidence. What evidence does they use to say, oh, I need to do something else? And it's not simple, and a lot of it is not that nice package that they'll read a research result and go, oh, how silly me, you know, I've got to do it differently. So the question we asked was, can you think of a time when something, an event, an article, a conversation, a reflection, an idea, a meeting, a plan, caused you to make a change in your teaching? What was it and what happened? We had a variety of ways of collecting this. Some of this was online, some of this was face-to-face, and we had 99 usable fragments, usable stories at the end of it, which we analysed on a number of dimensions, and I'm not going to give you the whole works here. I'm just going to pull out some features. And one of the features is we started to observe where change actually happens. And change happens at a number of places. Certainly it happens with students, it happens in classrooms, it happens within the course. The course is quite a common unit, a scope of change, a course or module or whatever you want to call it. A department or a school is another area where change happens, an institution. And then there's disciplinary. There's this idea that, well, we're all teaching Python now. It's sort of this change that happens not at any... it happens at lower levels as well, but it actually sits in that area. So there's a scope of change that we hadn't necessarily appreciated before we started. And then there's also change over time. And I think when we started, we had thought that we would observe change at the sort of the one student in the classroom now level. That's where change is enacted. That's where it lives. So when we started looking at these fragments, these stories that we collected about change, we found some interesting things. So here's one of them. And this person says, "I'm a member of a science education reading group on campus." That's quite a good thing, by the way. One of the papers recently was on how to evaluate your assessments, specifically tests, exams. One person in our reading group was a psychologist who researches psychometrics and does extensive quantitative test analysis for her courses. Based on her experiences and advice, I was inspired to go over a test I was in the process of writing for my CS0 course the following week. I reworked the exam to balance the material and more closely mirror what I wanted to assess in the class. This is now a standard practice before I give exams. That's quite an interesting story about how they made a change and what the source of the change was, But what I want to you to notice here is that they immediately instantiated it. They learned something and they went and did it the very next week. And that turns out to be a fairly common pattern. So here's another one. This is someone talking about the Nifty Assignments website. And it says, I've probably been there a handful of times when I needed new things. Pretty heavily about 4 years ago when we redesigned our intro class. We went through and picked out several assignments that we adapted. It's another common pattern when we redesigned our course. So the last time I taught it. And so that showed us that change has some rather strange quanta. It's not even. It's not, you know, today, tomorrow, the next day, next week, next year. Actually, it's the next time, it's the next session I teach, the next time I'm in the classroom, tomorrow, because that's when it happens, that's what I'm doing it. Or it's the next time I teach the same course. Now, that's liable to be at least a year in the future. Well, a semester in the future, at minimum. Most often a year, sometimes 2, 3, 4, 5 years before you teach it again. So you've got this rather strange periodicity that change takes. Equally, of course, you're drawing on inspiration from probably the last session that you taught or the last time you taught the class. And this stretches into the past and the future as well. So we found that we had a rather strange, a more complex delineation of the change space than we'd expected to see. And so if this is the site of change, if this change happens in the immediate or near future, then it's drawing on sources of change or rationales for change that are in the past. And I've made those boxes deliberately that height so that that's, you're looking probably at the level of the individual. These spaces delineate more or less individual change. So when we looked into the past, when we looked at the source of the change, we found that people did not rely on research questions or research evidence that they contain to change their practice. Frankly, they didn't even read very much research work. They read technical literature. So, you know, they'd read CSEM, they'd read software engineering journals, they'd read Dr. Dobbs, stuff like that. They'd read some papers from conferences like this, from SIGSE a bit, maybe, and that's about the extent of it. The most common source of change was local, contingent, and student-driven. So here's an example. I found that almost all the students who'd gotten the differentiate under the chain rule question wrong had done terribly on the exam. And almost all the ones who'd gotten it right had done quite well. So after that, I doubled the amount of time I spent teaching the change rule. So there you've got the evidence they used, what they did about it, and a little bit of what happened. Here's another one. On a data structure and algorithms exam, I frequently gave students recursive code to do something in a binary tree and asked them to give me the output. There was typically some numeric calculation. I would get 80% incorrect answers. I observed that students would show very little work. I changed the instructions to the problem to include showing the execution tree. Making students show their work flip-flop the percentages. Typically, 80% get the answer correct now. So again, you can see the source of the change, what they saw, what they did, and what happened. Quite often, these sources, these things that actually made a change, were quite visceral, were quite emotional. Actually, had not so much an intellectual content as a very personal content. So this is a person who had changed, made a big change for their course to introduce some very topical, very recent material. And their story was, when I looked into their eyes halfway through the introduction, I could see that a 15-month-old example was no longer topical. So we can imagine this is a person who's teaching the course the very next time. So this is a year later when they changed it, they put in this new, great, topical news story, they're teaching it again, and suddenly it isn't anymore. Indeed, most had never heard of something that had been a lead news item a short while ago. I rescued the class by managing to work in a more recent example, but the experience was a bit of a shock. And that's not unusual that they go, oh, it's failing, I'm not doing right, something bad's happening, and that's a source of change. And something that surprised us was often these sources, these rationales, were a long way in the past. Here's one I remember quite clearly. About 2 years after I started teaching, I was in London for a meeting with my old PhD supervisor. We were talking about our classes and she said, "Oh, I never do lectures." "Never," I said. "Really? Never? So what do you do?" And this was quite a long way in the past for this person, but had changed their teaching ever since. And this one is, initially in my lectures I used OHP slides with no handouts. Most of the time students were merely copying from the screen. This reflected my experience as a student. I often perceived the lecturer as a hindrance. He or she was making it hard for me to concentrate on slide copying. Yeah, I won't ask who still does this. It's okay. But you can see that this was a this had a huge effect. But the source, the initiating rationale for this was back in student days, was decades ago. So this made us realise that this change space was more complex than we'd thought. So I showed you the boxes there for the individual change, but that's not enough. There's these other spaces that are at the top of the map here. And this space we call the grand narrative space. This is sort of the future potential change. This is where sort of ABET accreditation lives, the ACMI, IEEE curricular guidelines. This is what we should be teaching. Quite often institutional missions, you know, let's change to look at graduate attributes, or we're changing the mission of how we teach. That lives up in that corner. And you see some of that. And equally in the history corner, you get the culture. You get to look there and see trends that maybe you would not have observed at the time. Maybe they were invisible to you when you were actually living through it, but you look back now and you see these cultural differences, things that happen. And so we came to realise that change is not a unitary thing. So if, for instance, you have someone who's making a change, the next class, the next time they go into the classroom, they're making a change. That change may be based on something that they experienced 20 years ago when they met their old supervisor in London. And that may be influenced because of the way they learned as a student. And so it's not a single point in time that we've come to believe that every change that's made actually implicates all parts of the space. If you have someone, for instance, who's making a change in the next time they teach the course, so this could be quite a long way in the future, it's almost certainly based on the last time they taught the course. I mean, many of us sit, you know, when we've taught a course, we make notes and go, "Oh, this didn't go so well, got to change this." You know, we annotate our slides, ready for when we pick them out next time and go, "Oh, yes, I'd forgotten that." But that same change that we're making to the next time we teach the course may also be influenced by stuff that's happening in, for instance, curricular guidelines, or we're going to teach Python this year instead of Java, or what have you. And so we see that it's not a simple thing. So, if change has this characteristic, if we're right here, if what we've done in this project says we should look at this more in a more nuanced fashion, what evidence, what representations are going to be useful to support this change? Now, many of the change stories are embedded in what someone told me, not what I read, not what I saw at a conference, not when I went on a workshop, but what someone told me. How others have done it seems to be an extremely fertile ground for finding out, for changing your practice. But when we're looking at teaching, when we're looking at that messy, situated end of the spectrum, how do we know that? I mean, think for a moment, just in your heads. How do you know what other people do when they teach whatever you teach, CS1 or HCI or data structures? And I think this is down to a very strange feature. There's a structural difference between research and teaching that is, I think, underappreciated. Because research is an activity that stands outside of any one institution. No one institution can do all the research in chemistry or physics or computer science. It's distributed amongst institutions as a matter of course. Now, as it happens, researchers gain internal value at my institution. I gain value at my institution for publishing papers, for getting awards, for getting grant income in, that my institution has no control over. They just recognise it and say, oh, well done. And if you're lucky, they promote you. And so what that means is research also always happens elsewhere. It's always happening outside the institution, or perhaps more particularly between institutions, in what Diana Crane calls invisible colleges. And these invisible colleges are people that I went to grad school with, people I've met at a conference, people I've published with. I read your papers, you read mine, we know what's going on with each other. I suggest to one of my grad students they go and work with you. And that means information is exchanged across and between universities just naturally, just as part of the activity. It's a structural feature of doing research. No one has to work at it to make it happen. And so I want to put another dimension on here, which is visibility. Okay? I didn't want to put it up at the beginning because I thought it might confuse you, but this spectrum, this continuum from teaching to research, also is a continuum of visibility. That the teaching end is, not, if it's not private to me, it's private to my institution. It rarely escapes. Research, on the other hand, is extremely visible, extremely public, and in publications. Now, teaching is institutional. And unless I've been employed in a lot of institutions, I don't really know how teaching is done elsewhere. And one of the things we did in the SHARE project was we actually followed people. We actually stayed with them for 2 or 3 years and interviewed them every few months, went and looked in their classrooms, got their course materials, to actually try and observe change. I don't think we were very successful in that part of the project, but it was an interesting exercise. But one participant, they were trying a new way of teaching sorting. It's not something they'd done before. And it was okay. It was a reasonably successful intervention. And so we'd followed them through, we'd followed them week by week, we'd seen what the students learned and if they liked it. And then we asked, if you could get advice on this intervention, if you could ask anyone you wanted, who would it be? What kind of person? To have made it better, to have helped you. And they said, it wouldn't be an expert in sorting. And luckily, we sat on our hands and waited for them to go on. Because that was a bit of a surprise, because you'd think, you'd say, well, I want to read the best person who knew about this. They said, it would be someone who taught this numerous times in various conditions and who knew how to deal with various constraints. I hadn't taught it under these constraints. So they were looking for the embodied, situated expertise. And then they said, actually, I don't know how others teach sorting, you or my colleagues. That's a bit shocking. I don't know how other people teach something as fundamental as sorting. I know what the algorithm is and the textbooks, but how do others get students through it? And for us, that encapsulated this privacy and invisibility of teaching. So, if teaching's not visible, institutions, in a sense, don't value it. Because they don't have the markers that they have for research, because they can't say, oh, someone else thinks you're a good teacher, the recognition and reward structures are very odd. Because they don't have that ability to do the same job as they do with research, they don't do the inverse, which is go, hey, we own teaching, we'll say what if you're good or not, and we'll promote you. They don't do that. And I don't quite understand why they don't, but they don't. And because of this dichotomy, something I think very dangerous happens. And it happens right here. Here's a recent study. This is a recent study in the UK called Reward and Recognition in Higher Education, Institutional Policies and Their Implementation. And these people sent out 2,768 questionnaires. No, they sent out more because that's what they got back. They did 31 semi-structured interviews, 15 with female staff, and they looked at 104 institutional promotion policies. So, I mean, they're turning the handle. They're doing the good stuff, they're getting the good data in that you have to do when you do research like this. And this was reported in the Times Higher, which is a bit like the Higher Education Chronicle. It's a national newspaper for higher education academics. And they said, based on her research, Annette Cashmore is developing a set of criteria for the evaluation of learning and teaching to form a national framework. And this is what she produced. So these are the criteria for lecturer, these are the criteria for senior lecturer, and these are the criteria for chair. Okay, just want to have a look at those for a moment, if you can read them. And I read those, and I looked at those, and I thought, something's wrong. Now, put aside the very expensive project that funded this. Put aside the Higher Education Academy, who regulates this kind of stuff in the UK. Surely these criteria can't be right. Because if you look at them, what they say is the more research-like an activity it is, the higher value it has on the scale. So let me put them back, and I'll change them. I'll change the terminology. So this looks more like your framework now, assistant associate and full professor. Okay. So have a look at them. I tell you what, look for your grade. Okay. Look for your grade on that chart and go, if I did that, would that be good teaching? Would someone promote me if I did those things? Or should they promote me if I do those things? Because I eventually got quite angry when I looked at this, because this hierarchy is a rhetoric of legitimation. It's not about practice at all. For instance, you know, own research in teaching and learning, which is one of the criteria for associate professor, says nothing about whether I'm a good teacher or not. Absolutely nothing. It doesn't discriminate me from anyone else except that I can write papers and get them published. And so what these criteria do, and I think it's a very common misconception, I'm holding these people up, but I don't think they're alone in this, is they're taking these external markers of validity that are structurally present in research and inappropriately applying them to teaching. And I think it's perpetuating an old confusion, which is, if teaching is undervalued and research is a valuable activity, if we treat teaching as if it was research, we'll give it more value. And I think quite the reverse happens. So, if on the one side we have abstract knowledge and a singular, often canonical representation, the paper, the journal paper, and it's public and embodied in publications. And on the other side, we have situated knowledge with multiple individual messy representations and institutionally private, if not personally private. What this rhetoric does, I think, is strip away the middle ground, strip away those other levels that we can talk about, merges these two incompatible extremes into some ghastly Frankenstein monster in the middle called, I don't know, tree church or reaching or something, which actually makes sense in neither camps. So, what would it mean to treat teaching as teaching, not as a second-hand cousin to research? How might we produce appropriate and preferably long-lasting representations of practice, not these fleeting ephemera that you get as produced as a natural result of teaching a course? Representations that are purposeful, that are abstracted a little bit from the day-to-day, from the quotidian, but have enough comparability and common form to be useful. Well, it's tricky, but I think I can do something there which is a less dangerous intervention than treating teaching as research. And what it is a model that I developed with Josh Tenenberg from the University of Washington, Tacoma, called the Disciplinary Commons. And the aims of the Disciplinary Commons, as I've talked, are to document and share knowledge about teaching and student learning. So we know teaching and learning happens. We want to document it in a way that we can share. And we hope that we would establish practices for scholarship by making these representations public, peer-reviewed, and amenable for future use and development by other practitioners. So if you like, trying to take that source of change, which is, oh, someone told me, I saw what they did, and actually take it out of the conversational. So what a disciplinary commons is it's 10 to 12 educators, typically, it's about the right number, sharing the same disciplinary background, often teaching very much the identical course, teaching CS1 or teaching software engineering, and they come together, so they leave their institutions, they come together in a neutral place once a month to discuss the course that they're teaching, the CS1 they're teaching in their own institutions, as it's progressing. And they do that every month for an academic year. So typically, we'll have 9 or 10 meetings over the course of a year. And when we meet, of course, we talk about our teaching, reflect, we share. We also observe, we do cross-institutional peer observations. And we have those deep, deep, meaty discussions that you like to have when you go, oh my God, how do you teach sorting, for instance? And by doing this, we gain an unusual depth of knowledge of practice in other places. We actually know very intimately how 8, 9, 10, 12 other people in other contexts with other constraints teach the same stuff that we're teaching. And because documentation of teaching practice is rare, and as we've seen is incohate, has no common form, is scattered all over these strange representations, we have a common form of documenting our practice coming out of these discussions. And we use a course portfolio, which has a common form, so we mandate a form. And because you've got 9, 10, 12, 17 portfolios, all for CS1, or software engineering, whatever, you can actually, someone else can take that set and look at them and search across them. So you get a good deal of contextualized data, but in an amenable form. So the form that we've mandated is, each of these portfolios have 6 sections. Context, because we know that's important. I would be a terrible teacher at Stanford or MIT or somewhere because I don't have that background and I don't teach that kind of student. Content, what do you actually include in your CS1? Is it different from what I include? What does that mean? Instructional design, do you use labs? Do you use lectures or something in between? Delivery, that's when we do peer observation. We stand up and see how each other does it. Assessment, do you have labs? Do you have exams? Do you have closed labs? Do you let them take in notes? Whatever. And evaluation. And that's not just evaluation, us evaluating the students, it's students evaluating us, the institution evaluating the success of our module. And in each of those sections, we include an artifact from the course. So you go, you want to see my exam? Here it is. And we choose the artifact that we think is important in that section for us. And of course, so different portfolios will have different emphases. Some people are more proud of certain aspects than others. And associated with that artifact is a commentary. Because one of the things we find about change is that people want to look. They want to go and look at the slide deck and say, oh, that's how they do it, I can take that, or that won't work for me. It's a very quick teaching decision. When you look at something, you go, yes, I can do that, or no, it won't work for me. And so including the artifacts allows us to bring our own expertise and our own knowledge to bear on whether it's suitable for us. It includes the detail and the discussion in the commentary, evidence of what's happening, a narrative on it, the what and the why. And this together creates a document that is personal. It's about me and my context, but it's not idiosyncratic. It's not individualistic. It's actually in a common representational form. So this knowledge is born out and from teaching. All commoners are expert. It's not someone with research knowledge coming in and telling us what to do. And commoners work together to find questions, to interpret, to reinterpret their own practice and others. And the resulting documentation is contextual, and inevitably, because it's the way it's been created, is 1 or 2 or 10 or 17 steps away from my individual embodied experience. It begins to externalise that. So it's quite a powerful way of supporting teaching. And here's a quote from someone who went through one of the very early instantiations of the commons. And they said, "I have never had any externality on teaching. The peer review process, the exposure of ideas. You present ideas and get them hammered down. That's all part of what I do on a day-to-day basis in research. Whereas teaching, it's something I keep in my pocket, you know? I'm getting this externality on the process, this peer review, these things that characterise a good research project, keeping up in the field, being aware of what other people are doing. I didn't do any of that for my teaching, I do now." And this person is saying that having come through this year-long set of meetings. So paradoxically, by treating teaching as teaching, what we've started to see is some of the behaviours that other people impute to research by assuming that teaching shares the same structure as research. We actually invert that. We say it doesn't share the same structure, but we want to achieve the same things, the visibility and the representations. And so by doing that, we've cut some of the beneficial behaviours. Here's a quote I'm very fond of, which is, "Sharing complex knowledge requires time devoted to either personal interaction or thoughtful documentation of one's expertise, or both." I think that's what we do when we put together a disciplinary commons, is that we share complex knowledge in personal interaction and in thoughtful documentation. And so those are the characteristics that we'd like to pull together. We hope, we like to believe, we're not, that Josh Schoenberg and myself aren't the only people who can put a commons together. So we've written a pamphlet for anybody who wants to try and do one of these themselves, called A Commons Leader's Vademecum. I have a few of them with me. It's available from the website. You can download it in the PDF if you're too late to get a copy from me today. I'd recommend it. It's a good experience. So let's look at questions. I said there were three axes that this continuum sits on. And we've looked at abstraction, we've looked at representations. We haven't particularly looked at questions. But I think each of these levels is distinguished by the different sorts of questions that we can ask and the different sorts of questions that we want answers to. So teaching, I mean, I've distinguished that very strongly from the others. What kind of questions do you see there? Well, we've seen some already. The gentleman who said that I found almost all the students had gotten the differentiation under the chain rule wrong. He was asking a question. He was asking a question of his practice. He said, I looked at this, I found there was a problem, I did something about it. No one would ever know if we hadn't asked that this change was made. This was a question, a perfectly appropriate level of question for practice, and he got a perfectly appropriate answer. So I think that characterises the kind of questions we see there. The computing education research questions, which is where I sort of entitled this talk and where I expected to start and finish. I'm not sure that I've quite fulfilled that brief, but these questions are over more than one classroom. So they're not about singular practice, singular hidden private practice. They're about stuff that we can share. So examples of those are, there's the McCracken study, 10 years old now, where they took 10 institutions and gave students the same program exam and see how they did. Not well, which is an interesting result. And from that, things like Raymond Lister's bracelet project, where again they take multiple institutions and do the same interventions in the classrooms. So this, I think, is computing education research. Another way that you can sensibly talk about more than one classroom is to use an instrument that generalizes. So use an instrument that is not developed within your classroom. You bring it in from outside, you bring in some kind of inventory, some kind of questionnaire, and because that's been validated in other circumstances, that would generalise some of the claims you're making from your classroom. And I would put those questions, that level of question, as being part of computing education research. Research questions themselves, these very abstract questions that circulate within a research community, These ask general questions of teaching and learning. So what is computational thinking is a common one. And I think as we see CS and programming move down into high schools and then down lower into primary schools, we're going to see more of this kind of question. We're going to see more of the fundamental what is math skill questions that you look at 5-year-olds, 6-year-olds, 7-year-olds. What are language skills? And I think we're going to see a lot of more research in this area looking at what are computational skills for that age group. Sort of general sort of cognitive ability questions rather than anything we do in the classroom. Or evaluating the work example effect in light of the theory of cognitive load. Questions that may come from another discipline, they may come from psychology, but we're instantiating them in a variety of classrooms. Also, I would say general research would be techniques that cross disciplines. Problem-based learning is a very classic one here. Problem-based learning originated in medicine, moved fairly quickly to engineering, and is now percolating out across many disciplines from there. So I would categorise that level of abstraction as a research question. The category that I've pretty much avoided throughout the entire talk has been this problematic teacher-researcher category. This category that is not the private invisible teaching. It's not the cross-classroom stuff of computing education, but it's that one step away. And I would say that that level relies on simply asking questions. And you may quite rightly ask, what does that mean? Well, let's go back a bit. Do you remember this guy? This was the guy who, on a data structure and algorithms exam, gave students recursive code and they get 80% incorrect answers. He observed that students would show very little work. He changed the instructions to the problem to include showing the execution tree, and making them show their work flip-flopped the percentages. He now gets 80% correct answers. Now, I would characterise that as a teaching question. Right over, it's in the practice, it's in the weeds. He looked at it within his classroom, he did something about it, and it worked. What would you do to ask questions of this practice? If I'm saying now that what you need to do to move to teacher researcher is simply ask questions, what questions would you ask, or ask of this guy, or if this was you, would you ask of that practice that might be interesting to move out of the weeds, out of the quotidian, out of the classroom? I think they might look something like this. Why did making students show their work alter their performance? What would making students show their work in other contexts improve their performance in those areas too? What do students do when they show their work? And do students' workings look similar to each other's, similar to the ones that they've been taught, or are they individualistic and separate? And if you're interested in asking those kind of questions, and if you're interested in finding the answer to those kinds of questions, I think you're moving slightly out, moving over to that teacher-researcher area, which I think is an extremely important, extremely sensitive, and extremely overlooked part of this curriculum, this continuum. And I think it's the kind of questions that we ask in this kind of situation, in this kind of conference, and others like them. And I strongly encourage it. So, back to the beginning. Computer education research, who's it for and why? Well, I'd say it's for all of us. Not all at the same level, and not all the time. But I want to leave you with a suggestion that we can, and should, produce representations of our practice at every level. We can and should consult representations each other's practice at every level. There's a lot of work out there, and we shouldn't ignore it. And we can and should ask questions of our own and others' practice at every level. And I hope that I've convinced you that that's important too. Thank you for listening.
We We've got about 10 minutes for questions, if anyone has them for Sally. We only have one mic, so just shout from the back, or you're welcome to come up and we'll hand you the mic. If there are no questions, student. Okay.
Televised lectures that many universities are putting out now. So you put a video camera in the classroom and someone stands there and instructs their stuff. Certainly they're a representation, the same way as a podcast or a series of lecture slides or anything like that is a representation. I think the majority of them are put out there for reputation purposes. So Stanford is going, hey, look how fantastic we are, MIT is going the same, University of Cambridge in the UK is doing the same. I don't see it so much done from institutions at my level in the hierarchy. And so you've got to ask, why are they doing it? Because they're almost impossible to learn from, I would say. Part of the context of teaching, part of its situated nature is that you are a Stanford student. You're sitting there with your friends and you've done the labs the day before and you know there's assessment coming. So it's, although they clearly are a representation, I'm not sure what job they're performing.
How do you, or do you try to measure the trade-offs between how much time participants in these comments you're talking about have put in compared to the benefit they get out, and how do you, as a person who might want to participate in this, justify this to your institution, which really has to supply a lot of time and resources to allow you time to participate.
Yeah. Did everybody hear that okay? Should I repeat it? Okay. It was about participation in the commons and the benefits and trade-offs. It does take time. There is no doubt it takes time. It's not only the one day a month that you go to meet with these people, there's the prep, and there's the and then there's the creation of the portfolio in the end. There's no doubt it's a time commitment. But so there is for writing a paper, so there is for every course. There's also, I have to say, a monetary commitment. It's not much, but if you're bringing people together from different places, you do have to support travel and support lunch and something like that. So there's a small monetary commitment as well. In terms of benefit, it's enormous. How else are you going to, you know, and your department, I mean, people who've been on Commons Report, they go back to their department goes, well, I don't know, should we do it like this, should we do it like this, and they go, well, you know, I can tell you how they do it at Hartford, I can tell you how they do it at Kennebec, I can tell you how they do it at Siena, and suddenly, the knowledge that you bring back, that you've gained by participation, I don't know how else you would gain it, is immensely valuable locally. So I think the departmental sell is quite easy if you've got a sympathetic chair.
So you mentioned that teaching is very context specific and it's very cited, and research is very abstract and general, and I feel like the organization that you've created trying to bring some of the aspects of teaching to share that knowledge to make it a bit more abstract and more general. But I was wondering if there are issues sometimes in it's important to share the context when providing the lessons you learn in a specific location, and it seems like it would be unlikely that a teacher from a different institution would have the same context. So I was wondering if you found that it's difficult for teachers to take lessons across context to their institutions? Is it the influx of new ideas that's important, or the application of something learned in a different context?
Okay, so the question was about if teaching is very contextual, which it is, how in the commons do people deal with that? is context so important it's a deal breaker? I've been working for a while on this notion of deal breaking ventures. I talked about it briefly, that when I come to a piece of practice, I come to a textbook, I come to an assessment, it's a very quick decision to go, that will work for me or that won't work for me. And some of those deal breakers are contextual. Some is, I teach 400 students. I'm not going to do, you know, an assessment that requires me to interview them all for half an hour each. Some of them are personal. Some of them are, oh, I tried that and it didn't work. I'm never going to do it again. But those rely on me knowing my context very well. You don't have to know my context to sell to me. I know it very well and I can make that decision. So in fact, the exposure to others' contexts just allows me to choose or to recognize the bits that might improve my practice. Or to go, oh my lord, I didn't know you had to do that if you taught in that way. So it's what I call a repertoire increasing activity. Rather than just being a single thing I can take down, it gives me a breadth to choose from.
All right, well, I'll give Sally a round of applause and thank her for attending today. Right, she'll be around throughout the conference to answer more questions, and Mark is going to tell us what's going to happen next.
Thank you, Sally and Brian, for the wonderful talk we just had. We have food being set up in the back, so we'll have that ready for you fairly shortly. I do have a couple of quick announcements that I'd like to make. First of all, for the student poster judging, if you have signed up, could you go back and see either Bob or Sandeep by getting forms to get that taken care of sometime fairly early this afternoon? And the second thing is, they can still use a few more judges. So if you haven't volunteered yet and you're willing to do that, that certainly makes things a lot easier. We unfortunately had to reject a few posters, not because of quality, and not even because of space, it's because it's very difficult to get judges, and as a result, that becomes a limiting factor. So we would certainly in the future like to be able to have as many posters. We had well over 65 posters submitted this year, where in the past 45 were the typical number. So the limiting factor, as I said, was the judging, so we had to sort of cap it because of that factor. The second thing I want to mention is that there are two vendor sessions at our conference, one next and then one during session two. So I'd like to point those out to you as well. And they are in Athletic Conference Room, which is on the second floor near the studios at that end of the building. So there will be food set up shortly. We have our first concurrent session starting at 2:30. So enjoy the rest of the conference. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, I've got everything. Yep.
Okay. Ooh, can I have an autographed one?
Of course you can.
Can I have one? Oh.